Okay, good. So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is May 2nd. Workers of the World Unite, 2012. And I want to welcome everyone. And tonight I want to talk about one of the factors of awakening in the Buddha's list of the seven factors of awakening. And this particular topic is concentration. And it's a topic that's been controversial in Buddhism probably since the very beginning. Definitely been controversial in the West in the last 20, 40 years or so. And so I'd like to talk about it in a frame in which, of course, see for yourself what you think is true and what's useful, and also open it up for some discussion about this particular subject, which will include a discussion of the non-ordinary states of awareness known as the jhanas, which have also been controversial the last 20, 30 years, as well as far longer than that. Okay, so that's the subject. To create a bit of a context here, as those of you that have come recently know, the Buddha offered a number of lists of various things, the Four Noble Truths, the Five Hindrances, the Seven Factors of Awakening, yada, yada, yada. No, I'm joking, no disrespect, man. And so among the seven factors of awakening, or the seven factors of awakening consist of mindfulness, investigation, energy, tranquility, concentration. I've lost one already.
Joy.
There we go. Thank you. Bliss, rapture. Thank you. And then concentration and equanimity. All right. So I'm talking tonight on the sixth of the list, which is concentration. So it's in the context of asking oneself, what is a cause? What is a factor of movement on one's own personal path of awakening? So the practical question down to earth is, what might be the benefit to each one of us in increasingly steadying the mind, even all the way to the point of non-ordinary states of consciousness that have to do with profound absorption in some object of attention? So how might that be useful to one? So I'd like to explore that with you. So to put this in context, as you may well know, in Buddhism, it's considered that there are three fundamental pillars of practice. Those are virtue, concentration, or mindfulness, and wisdom. Sila is the Pali word for virtue. Samadhi, the Pali word for concentration. You may know from Hinduism that samadhi refers to deep, including non-ordinary states of consciousness. And then last, punya, which is wisdom. So you have these three fundamental pillars of practice. There are three pillars, not two, right? And one of those pillars includes the pillar of samadhi, or mindfulness slash concentration. It's also said that one can categorize or sort the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth of the Noble Truths in Buddhism. And just again, a quick review. Those eight elements are, they cluster. I'll kind of reorder it in this way. The sila, or virtue, elements of the Eightfold Path are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The samadhi, or concentration, pillars, or aspects of the Eightfold Path are right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration. And the wisdom components of the Noble Eightfold Path are right intention and right view. See how those cluster? So sometimes people think about them in terms of a sequence that begins with right view and then moves into intention, and then the practices of right livelihood, right speech, and right action, and then really goes into the deep end of the pool with right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration. Okay. Actually, the way the Buddha taught these is he started with virtue. He said, put your own house in order first. And the beginnings of virtue are generosity. Generosity to oneself, which is who is a primary beneficiary of generosity, as well as generosity to others. Because that's what calms and cools the mind, and then enables us to simplify our life enough and quiet the mind enough that we can really tip into concentration, the fruit of which is wisdom. So it's often placed last, actually. The wisdom components of the Eightfold Path tend to be placed last in many traditional sequences. In the West, we tend to start with the really cool stuff, the cosmic teachings. We do those first, but traditionally, virtue came first, then concentration, then the profundity of insight. In actual practice, they're all important. I think of them a bit as a spiral. You know, often people come to this with a sense of there's some intuition that the insight teachings are correct, that actually everything changes and everything truly is connected to everything else, so that if one gets with that program, one is happier and produces benefit for oneself and others. And if one resists impermanence and interdependence, then one suffers and creates harms for oneself and for others. All right. So sometimes there's a kind of intuition that that's actually the case, which then leads people to cool the fires of the passions and regulate themselves better, maybe take on some precepts like not killing, not stealing, not lying, not harming through sexuality, not using intoxicants that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. And then on the basis of that, there's a growing capacity to steady attention, to rest the spotlight of attention where one wants and not have it hijacked by other things. And on the basis of that, deepen and deepen and deepen in wisdom. And then as one cycles through that, one then comes out, having deepened in wisdom, to a growing and even deeper quality of wholesomeness and virtue, even moving toward a kind of holiness, frankly. And then that affords oneself the capability of an even deeper kind of penetrating concentration, which leads to even deeper wisdom. So this is a nice kind of spiraling effect. But throughout, no way around it, there's a place for steadiness of mind. So the meaning of concentration technically in Buddhism really has two kinds of meanings. The general meaning is that it is steadiness of mind. Actually, I want to say this a little differently. Okay. So what does concentration mean? It has two kinds of meanings that are relatively general. One meaning of concentration is a deepening absorption in a single object of attention. So concentration is distinct from what's called open awareness. In open awareness, we just let things go through, whether we're meditative or in everyday life. But the meaning of concentration is that instead of doing that, we dive deeply into one thing. Maybe it's the sensations of breathing. Maybe it's a particular saying. Maybe it's a loving kindness feeling. We go deep into one thing. That's a common meaning of concentration. A second common meaning of concentration is it's called concentration of openness. We establish a profound and not typical steadiness that is unmoved by all that moves through awareness. That concentration is the basis for open awareness practices. It's more challenging to stay really present with everything moving through awareness than it is to stay present with a single object of attention. But often people start by trying to do open awareness practices and then get frustrated because they haven't yet built up the muscle of steadiness of mind to be able to do that. So those are the two general meanings for concentration in Buddhism. And is that distinction clear? First, deep absorption in one thing, and what that is like practically speaking, using the breath as an example and using meditation as an example, is you basically say, I'm going to keep attention on the nuances of the physical sensations of breathing, let's say located at the upper lip, inhalation, and exhalation for the next 45 minutes. And anything that comes up, the least beginnings of a thought elsewhere, I'm going to drop it and return that spotlight of attention to that particular object of attention. There's a muscularity to it. There's an absorption in it. There's a giving over to it. It's a kind of renunciate practice. It's sort of simple in a way as a meditative practice. It's the breath or off, right? The other kind of practice is often based on centering initially, maybe by starting 5 or 10 or 20 minutes on some particular object of attention, like the breath, and then relaxing and staying open and steady in the moment without being taken away by anything, without chasing something pleasant, without resisting something unpleasant, without planning, without worrying, you know, without hope or despair, as is traditionally said, you know, completely solid here. That's the other kind. Okay, those are the general meanings of the word concentration. Okay, so far? All right. Now, why is concentration valuable? And then I'll get to a specific technical meaning of concentration, which equates it with these four jhanas, which I'll get to momentarily. So concentration does a lot for us. For one, the more deeply we become absorbed in something, even if it's an absorption in presence that allows everything to flow through, what that does is it pushes the hindrances to the side. In other words, in a state of great steadiness of mind, you may have noticed there's no room for greed, broadly defined, to arise. The desire for things, the chasing after what's pleasant, the wanting. A little bit of neuroscience here. Basically, there are two kinds of systems that get caught up in greed or wanting. One is what's called appetitive, where we are just kind of looking for something to want. It tends to drive in mammals what's called foraging, just kind of wandering, looking. You see a lot of foraging behavior in malls, right? You can see foraging behavior, to be blunt, people searching for a fix or, you know, some turn-on of some kind. A singles bar is full of a lot of foraging behavior. And in it, you know, experientially, it has a subjective feeling of looking for something to want. You know, there's a kind of, there's a looking, there's a longing, there's a yearning there. That's foraging behavior. And then there's what's called consummatory behavior, where we consume the pleasure. You know, we're looking for something good to eat, and then it finally gets here, and we go yum, yum, yum. So the first kind of wanting is sort of anticipatory, right? We're imagining how good it would be if. Or we're looking for something to imagine how good it would be if. And the other kind of wanting is, I got it, I like it, I want it, I want more. All right, that's the other kind. So we can experience that. Well, interestingly, you may have noticed it even tonight when we did this, that a kind of peacefulness comes over people when they're in an absorption state. There's less and less of that wanting, which has a contracted quality, a craving quality, a suffering quality. As well, in terms of the second hindrance, there isn't hatred. In other words, there isn't an aversion. There's a falling away of anxiety, which is a subtle kind of aversion. It's very important to appreciate that under the hatred category of the three fuels or the three poisons in Buddhism, hatred, quote unquote, encompasses anxiety. We're unsettled. We're apprehensive. We're worried. We're uneasy about. We are threatened. Reactive. Okay, doesn't mean don't deal with real things. You know, fix the leaky roof. Don't let the dog bite you. Whatever, pay the IRS, whatever it is. But it means that we don't need to have a fearful reaction to that threat or that situation, that need. Okay, so there's a falling away as well with concentration of fearfulness or being at war with anything, including at war with our own body. There may be pain, but we're not at war with it. We're not upset by it. That hindrance has been pushed aside. A third hindrance is what's called restlessness, sometimes called restlessness and remorse, or just restlessness. We're restless, right? We're fidgety. We're not being stimulated enough. When we tip into absorption, we tend to be very stimulated by it, because we're very given over to it. Even if it's something as relatively bland as the breath, it really feeds us. So we're not restless anymore. That hindrance has been pushed aside. Fourth hindrance, sloth and torpor. We're not so sleepy. We're not so lazy. When we're absorbed, it often has a kind of energy that comes with it. And minimally, even though our body may be quiescent, our mind is engaged with the object of attention. That hindrance is pushed aside. And then the fifth hindrance, sometimes called the worst hindrance of doubt, not having confidence in our own practice, not having faith in what we're doing, ultimately in the Buddhist frame, faith in the teacher, the teaching and the community of the taught, the teacher being the Buddha, as well as the inner teacher, that inner capacity that we all have to know what the truth is and give over to it. Well, that hindrance falls away increasingly with steadiness of mind. So what do we have when there's a lot of steadiness of mind such that the hindrances are at least temporarily, not permanently eradicated? We're not enlightened yet, but they're temporarily pushed aside. We have a taste of freedom. We have a taste of what awakened consciousness is like, which can be very wonderful and motivating. So that's one of the reasons, one of the advantages, one of the values of concentration, the moving aside of the hindrances. People sometimes, and it's a question of degree, as they tip into more and more deeper and deeper and more stable states of concentration, it feels like such a relief. You know what I'm talking about? It has this relief feeling, like, wow. And it, and there's this funny sense, like, wow, this is how it could be, which can be also motivating as well. We want to stay away from judging ourselves that, you know, when we lose that sense that has the hindrances at bay or get caught up in measuring ourselves to others. But there's a healthy motivation that's inspired by a felt experience of what life could be like, what the mind could be like, what this could be. A second value of concentration is that it leads to a kind of calm. People whose mind is really steady are less shaken by what's going through. Well, that alone can feel good. It feels good to have a kind of deep keel in the water. That also enables us to be more virtuous, because when our mind is steadier and we're less swept away by things, we're not so hijacked. And it's easier to abstain from what's problematic and also take the high road instead of the low road. So steadiness of mind, concentration aids virtue. It also aids equanimity. We become less and less reactive emotionally. It's harder and harder to make us feel frightened or angry or frustrated or disappointed or to make us feel lonely or rejected or inadequate. It takes more and more to do that. We're just steadier and steadier and steadier and steadier. And then last, the last benefit I'll just mention of concentration is that really serves penetrating insight. When the mind is increasingly quiet and the sediments have settled out, the water is increasingly still, and there's a tranquility in the body, there's that removal of the hindrances, we can start to see with a growing laser-like penetrating focus the categorical nature of mind, not just the nature of individual reaction cascades, like, oh, you remind me of my mother, and you remind me of my father, and there we go yet again. That's useful, right? But that's content-specific. What happens when we have increasingly penetrating concentration is we start seeing more acutely into the flow of mind itself. We start seeing, for example, how conditional mental phenomena are, how they're created by conditions, and they pass away due to conditions. We start seeing more and more acutely on a time scale of quarters of a second how transient things are and how unreliable any experience is as a basis for true happiness. And that feeds a growing disenchantment. We wake up from the spell, from the mind. We're less and less caught by it. And we also, perhaps, have a growing intuition of the unconditioned, what the Buddha called the deathless nature or ground, out of which everything arises, that which doesn't change. To quote the Buddha, you know, the person who's on the path finds that which does not burn, that which does not decay, that which is the fundamental unchanging nature of things that's both generative and unconditioned, and in that his or her mind delights. Isn't that a lovely line? in that his or her mind delights. So that is increasingly available to us. As the mind gets quieter and quieter through concentration, we see more and more deeply. We also see more and more deeply into the illusion of self. We start realizing more and more acutely that while we are a person, we are a standing wave of sorts that has some continuity to it, that the presumption that there's a coherent, unified, enduring, and independent I looking out through the eyes, that one does not exist. In other words, that one is not merely an ephemeral, empty pattern of consciousness, but you cannot find that one anywhere in the mind altogether. And that becomes also increasingly liberating. So these are some of the opportunities of insight, and the insight that ultimately, irrevocably leads to the ending of suffering. So I have a quote for you here from one of my favorite Buddhist books. I've recommended it before. It's called Satipatthana, which is about the four foundations of mindfulness. And there's a little quote here that I'll read to you about the benefits of steadying the mind. All right? So the monk Anilayo, who has written this book, says, "As a matter of fact, full awakening requires a purification of both the cognitive and the affective, emotional aspect of the mind." Now, right there, it's interesting. He's saying that there needs to be a purification of view, which is the cognitive aspect, but there also needs to be a purification of the body and the heart. So, although on theoretical examination, these two aspects of the path might appear different, in actual practice, they tend to converge and supplement each other. So we're talking about clarity as well as calm, these insight and calm, calm being steadiness of mind, peacefulness, inner peace, insight and inner peace to a profound extent in both regards. That's what he's talking about here. A practitioner might develop one or the other aspect to a higher degree at different times, but in the final stages of practice, both calm and insight need to be combined in order to reach the final aim, full awakening, the destruction of both passion and ignorance. Passion, understood in a technical sense, as that which disturbs the body and the heart, and ignorance, in a technical sense, understood as that which clouds the mind. That's the melding of what's called traditionally shamatha, or calm, tranquility, deep concentration, and vipassana, which is insight. You know, a traditional metaphor for these two is that we find ourselves in a forest of suffering, and we want to make our way to the mountain, if you will, a mountaintop of freedom and true happiness and liberation. How do we do it? Well, the good news, number one, is all we need to do is to cut a path. We don't need to cut down the whole forest. Right? We don't need to take care of everything. We just need to get to that place of liberation and freedom. How do we do it? Well, we could take a razor blade, very sharp, and cut our way through the forest. Not very effective, probably, right? Or we could take a stick and start whacking down these trees and vines. Not very effective either. Or we could combine the two. We could get a machete that's very heavy, that's razor sharp. The heft of the machete is concentration, steadiness of mind, penetrating absorption. And the sharpness of the blade is the insight of vipassana. Clarity of discernment, seeing what's acutely the case. The two go together. We need both of those things. Any questions or comments so far? My personal experience, and it's certainly been true for me, is that steadiness of mind is the weak suit. People may have a fairly acute razor blade, but they would really profit, especially in the beginning to intermediate stages of practice, of building up the heft of their personal machete, steadiness of mind. Yeah, please.
What are the metta practices
Okay. Well, metta is the Pali word for loving kindness, as you know, and metta practice takes the feeling of compassion, which is the wish that a being not suffer, or the feeling and attitude, the intention of kindness, which is the wish that a being be happy, and in practical life, they tend to mush together, okay? And then what one does in a meditative way, in a formal sense, or in everyday life, is really trying to cultivate that experience. Okay. So one can work with metta in either the first sense of concentration that I said, which is an absorption into the experience, sometimes organized around a particular phrase or sequence of phrases like, may you be safe, may you be healthy, may you be happy, may you live with ease, you know, or simply the feeling of it. And the feeling, the experience, if you will, of compassion or kindness or both mushed together becomes the object of attention, distinct from the sensations of breathing. That's a way to do it. I think it's possible to really ground in a profundity of whole body metta as a stable, in the second sense of concentration, as a stable base from which one allows the everything to flow through awareness. I've never heard anyone talk about that, but I think that's quite possible, and a lot of us, me included, have intuitively found our way there. So you're in a place where you are love. Love is where you come from as everything, the sounds, sights, sensations, the occasional thought, an awareness of someone move through consciousness. Yeah, great. One more? Karen.
Yeah, when you started with the benefit of concentration, the seclusion from the hindrances.
Yeah.
I think sometimes that manifests more like, for those of us who aren't enlightened yet, maybe not total seclusion from the hindrances, but maybe more awareness of when, say, a hindrance arises in the mind. Yeah.
Sure.
Or, oh, there's a disliking or a grasping.
Right.
And then the other benefit of the clarity or insight, I think sometimes, you know, the beginnings of that might manifest like a little easier to make a big decision.
Hmm.
All of a sudden, the decision just seems like one way to go is the right way.
Yeah. Oh, good. Thank you for adding that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the benefits of steadiness of mind in everyday life, including being in a business meeting and not so distracted. You know, a lot of research shows, too, that teaching kids some kind of steadiness of mind has a lot of practical benefits, too.
Sorry. With the
Great. Great. Thank you. One last person, then I'll move on. Yeah, please.
I just kind of missed, what was it that built the muscle of steadiness? Was there a particular, was it vipassana or samadhi, like on one point?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that, actually. It's a great question, so how to do it. So I'm going to kind of slide fairly quickly into the how to do it phase. Okay? Okay, great. So now, but before I do that, I want to talk about the jhanas. The jhanas are the specific technical meaning of right concentration in the Eightfold Path. All right, and I want to read you a passage here. Here we go. So I think I'm going to comment a little bit as I read it. I'll try not to be too annoying about that. Here we go. So this is the Buddha speaking. And what is right concentration? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, forgive me, let me just stop. One way to listen to this language is that it's sort of inspired religious exhortatory language. A different way to listen to it is that it's very precise instructions. like literally how to repair your Volkswagen, you know, or Windows for Dummies or something. It's like very, this is how to ski. This is the Buddha telling us how to ski. It's a different way. And so then there's a way to listen to the words as these words mean a particular thing. They map to a specific psychological state or factor or condition. So I invite you to listen to these in that way and to bring it home to your own experience. So, and what is right concentration? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained attention, with rapture and joy born of seclusion. With the subsiding of applied and sustained attention, you enter into and dwell in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without sustained and applied attention, and has rapture and joy born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, you dwell equanimous, and mindful and clearly comprehending, you experience happiness with the body. You enter and dwell in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, you are equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and dejection, you enter into and dwell in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right concentration. So you have these four distinct states of mind, and I want to talk about what they are. People talk about and teach about the jhanas in different ways. And having prodded my own teachers for some clarity, I've come to realize that the truth is that there are simply different ways of talking about these, and there are different degrees of depth, if you will. And so, without getting into controversy about it, I'll just describe some of these distinctions. All right. So, the first key distinction is, if one is in a jhana, does one have access to sense data around oneself? Can one hear someone coming into and out of a room? One way these are described is that that is required. That if you are aware of sound around you, you're not in a jhana. It's also described sometimes that if you can think, you're not in a jhana. If you can have a reflective thought about what you're experiencing, you're not in a jhana. This is the view taken by people like Ajahn Brahm, who teaches in Australia. His wonderful book, Mindfulness, Bliss, and Beyond, describes this. Pa Ok Sayadaw, many other traditional teachers take that view. Right? On the other hand, if you read the very recurring description of the jhanas, which happens again and again and again and again and again, there is no requirement for this lack of awareness of sense data. And in fact, there are many passages that refer to insight occurring during a jhana state, which must therefore entail some kind of capacity for thought. I prodded a key teacher of mine, Christina Feldman, on this, and her answer basically was, she said, well, maybe there are different levels of jhana. So I leave that distinction to you. The second key question is whether the capacity to enter these non-ordinary states of awareness is required for full awakening. The Buddhists gave us the Eightfold Path, not the Sevenfold Path. He made it quite clear again and again and again that there was a progressive process that typically moved through these absorption states. And that, in fact, this capacity to enter these states was essentially required for very high levels of awakening. All right. In my view, at least, there's not much question about that. And to offer an opinion, for me, it's been curious and odd as an historical phenomenon that there's been such disinterest in a way in the jhanas, particularly in Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, and even in Theravadan / Vipassana Buddhism in the West in the last 10, 20, 30 years. There's a kind of movement back into engaging the jhanas as a very important part of practice and one that's actually accessible to regular people. Often it's regular people on retreat for, you know, a week, 10 days, ideally even longer. But, you know, as I say, it's the Eightfold Path, not the Sevenfold Path. So see for yourself what you think about these different things. One of the pitfalls of concentration in general and jhana practice in particular is that one can fail. And for people in the West in particular who are kind of prone to self-criticism and comparison and so forth, you know, there's been some thought deliberately from teachers not to emphasize this aspect of practice because we might quite all too easily get our knickers in a twist about it. On the other hand, I think, look, just because a path has pitfalls doesn't mean you don't walk the path. You try to stay off the pitfalls. Or if you find yourself in a pitfall, you try to get back on the path. For me, it's been actually very important to engage steadiness of mind. And when it's appropriate and possible, as on retreat, and the conditions are ripe, to explore the possibility of these depths of awareness. But see for yourself what's true for you. Okay, good. So then the question becomes, now to the meat of it all, in a sense, how to do it and how? What are the factors? So traditionally, there are said to be 5 factors of the jhanas. And you can apply this to, as Karen was saying, even more everyday states of concentration or steadiness of mind. The first factor is applying attention. So if you imagine the breath, if the breath is the object of attention, it's applying attention to the beginning of an inhalation. And the second factor is sustaining attention. If you recall the description of the first jhana, applied and sustained attention were present. There's still some willfulness. There's still some subtle willfulness around and intentionality around attention in the first jhana in terms of applied and sustained attention. Sally Clough Armstrong, to me, has a lovely metaphor of applied and sustained attention. I'm thinking of the breath. Imagine a figure skater or an ice skater. You plant the foot, that's the application of attention to the beginning of an inhalation or exhalation. And then you glide, you sustain attention to that inhalation or exhalation. And then you plant the foot again, as you apply attention, let's say, to the exhalation and sustain attention to it over and over and over again. The key is applying the attention in the first place and having that application of attention become increasingly habitual in, let's say, a formal meditative practice. Okay? Or weaving steadiness of mind into everyday life. Those are the first 2 factors. The third factor is rapture or bliss. It's called piti. It's a very strong feeling, often energetic, pulses of pleasure in the body. The Buddha described rapture as something one should become fully given over to so that it saturates one's being, you know, like water filling dry powder. If one were to knead the water into the dry powder to make a more of a clay or dough-like substance, all-pervading, that's the factor of kind of intense pleasure or absorption, bliss even. 4th factor is joy. Joy is on a spectrum from happiness to contentment to tranquility. It's a quality of happiness. The Pali word for that is sukha, which is the root of the Sanskrit word for sucrose or sugar. It's sweet. There's a sweetness to that joy. You may recall in the description of the first jhana, it referred to rapture and joy. And then the 5th factor is singleness of mind, a kind of sometimes called unification of awareness. It's a sense in which rather than in the field of awareness, one little thing being foregrounded after another in the spotlight of attention, it's as if the whole spotlight widens out to encompass the whole field. Those are the 5 jhana factors. And a person can engage them in a home practice. We can engage applying and sustaining attention even if we're a one-minute meditator. You can. We can also open to some qualities of well-being, joy, and even encourage them as best we can. Thinking of things that make us happy, gratitude, gladness. We can gladden the heart. We can really stir that up. So those three factors, I think, are quite accessible in everyday practice. And then with experience and even with the duration of a single time of meditation, we can also invite bliss or rapture. And truly, it becomes increasingly available at will. I think there's a spectrum of people in terms of their accessibility to bliss. Some people can just go into bliss like that. Other people, it's much harder to go into. I think I'm kind of in the middle, and I become more and more able to just self-activate that kind of rapture state, which can become really quite intense, especially on retreat, when one gives oneself over to it increasingly. So I think that's a stretch. That's like a stretch goal. But it's really okay to play around with this stuff. That's one thing I really encourage you to. The Buddha said, here, try it, essentially. And then the fifth factor, I think, is also available. It's a stretch. The sense of everything kathunk, coming together in a sense of gestalt awareness, experience unified as known in the mind moment by moment, all elements of one's experience known together at the same level, as it were, not one foregrounded over any other, all of experience known at once, moment by moment by moment in awareness. A nice way into that is to start by sensing the breath as a whole, starting in the torso, then the overt sensations of breathing, including the subtle ones in the shoulders and hips, and inside the lungs, and then the body as a whole. That's a way out that can support this kind of unification of consciousness. So those are the jhana factors, the five factors. So any questions or comments about them? And then I'll talk a little more specifically about everyday steadiness of mind.
It would seem like rapture would be the last one. I was confused.
Yeah,
order.
I know. I've wondered about that too. Why would you put rapture? And I've had teachers who tell me that rapture, even though for sure it's one of the seven factors of awakening, you know, it's not always that accessible to people. But fundamentally, that quality of happiness, the gladness of the heart, is accessible to people. So I'm going to finish up momentarily, but yeah.
Just, so I started getting really distracted by all this energy and like my hands, and it all felt really good, and I was getting really upset, like, go back to your bed, and then I finally gave in. I was like, okay, I'm just going to do it. So
yeah.
Is that a distraction, or is was that rapture?
I think, that's rapture. That's a taste of it. That's a taste of PD. People experience PD in different ways. And second, what you can do, which was offered to me by Christina Feldman, is change the object of attention from the breath, let's say, or a loving kindness phrase, to the rapture.
That's kind of what it
is. Or to joy. You know, one can let any one of these things become the object of attention. It's not supportive of concentration to jump around a lot, but if it works for you, you can really intensify the factor of rapture by making it your object of attention. So I have a practical suggestion for you, and then I'll wrap up, okay? My practical suggestion for you is, if you have a sitting practice, hopefully you do, of some kind, maybe even a daily one, which would be really good, if you like, for a while, explore steadiness of mind, where in a muscular way, you give your attention over to either a very specific focus of attention, or if you want, having stabilized your concentration to some extent, you just stay present in an open awareness state. And when your mind wanders, you bring it back quickly. And you really adopt a kind of renunciate stance when you're doing this practice of you're either on the trail or off the trail. And anything other than the object of attention or a stability in which you allow the contents of mind to flow through, anything other than that, and which includes a kind of recollected presence. You are present. Anything other than that is off purpose, and you come back to the purpose over and over again. Not with harshness, you know, not with self-criticism, but with kind of building this muscle. I really invite you to do that. My own practice, to finish up, when I reflect on the last 15, 20 years, has really taken off for based on three things in reflection. The first was steadiness of mind. The second was positive emotion, rapture and joy. Wow, that's very powerful. Including loving kindness, that's a kind of joy. Love for others, that's a very positive feeling. And the third thing for me has been generosity. So, to myself and to others. So how about we sit for 1 minute? We give ourselves the generosity, one last minute of attention here, and then we'll wrap up. Might experience steadiness of mind in a very down-to-earth way as sustaining a kind of center or field of presence through which moment to moment life flows. Thank you for your steadiness of mind tonight. Take good care.